Yeah, we talked about, actually, could somebody remind me what letter I used for the splitting functions yesterday? Was it P or something else? Is P? Okay, good. So the splitting function is just a function of z, but it's sort of the most differential thing we talked about. So if you multiply it by these uniform prefactors, then this is just the probability, those sort of in a fully differential slice in KT and z, the probability that a particle x would split into a particle y that carries fraction z of its energy and has that kt, so that component kt, a particular kt transverse to the direction of x's energy, x's momentum, and then plus something else. So this is a fully differential thing. Then we talked about two things that are basically, you can think of them as integrated over kt versions of the p. And because it's an integral over kt, now it does care about what kt you're evaluating it at. So those were the fragmentation function f of, I'll stick to z, q for x going to y, and the parton distribution function, which, believe it or not, is also usually denoted by the symbol f, x goes to y, of z and q. Totally different. The fragmentation function, they are very similar. The fragmentation function now refers to forward evolution. Let's say x is a quark, y is a gluon, radiating off some particle of y. Question is, what's the probability that x will radiate a y? Or it could be that x survives radiation. I mean, y could be the same as x, and then we'd call it the other kind of radiation, or we'll more generally split into a y with energy z times ex and kt less than q. And this refers to the final state evolution. When you produce an x, what kind of emission comes out? Where now the if this four momentum is q, this is k, and this is p, q squared is greater than p squared. Okay, this is a more off-shell particle. P could be on-shell, it could be a little off-shell, but generally we're interested in q squared greater than p squared. If that weren't true, you wouldn't be able to. I mean, when you radiate something off, you always lose mass, right? You always lose, I mean, four-vector mass, invariant mass. Think of it like a decay. If you had a heavier particle, it could decay to a lighter particle plus a massless particle, or to two lighter particles. And q squared should also be greater than p squared and k squared. Now, in this case, we are talking really about the same kind of diagram, but with a very different, in a different regime, where q squared, so this is p, I'll again make that y, this is k, where q squared is actually less than p squared. This is relevant for, in this context, by the way, y, you could talk about y as a hadron. You could talk about the probability of a quark fragmenting to a particular hadron. Here, you can talk about x as a hadron. And the picture is, as you probe at higher and higher momenta the structure of x, you start seeing its ability to decompose into other things. And so you're probing the decomposition of x into less on-shell gluons and quarks as you go to higher and higher virtuality in the collisions. Probably that doesn't completely do justice to the quest to the issue, but I want to move on now to, unless if there's any questions, we can talk about this more. Otherwise, I'd like to move on to the Higgs mechanism.
Difference between those
They follow the same kind of evolution equation. The difference is in where they apply. The parton distribution applies in initial states to collisions, and the fragmentation function applies in final states of a collision. So in initial states, you start out with something that's on shell, and then you want to study how it can be thought of as being built of things that are more and more off shell. For a final state, it goes the other way around. So probably that is the one word that you should associate with each one of these. Fragmentation functions go out, parton distributions go in. All right, so actually the rest of the class I plan to spend on different aspects and features of the Higgs mechanism, Higgs particles. Today I'm going to introduce it in the sort of canonical way, the way that it was originally motivated. Just a gauge theory to describe the standard model. How does it work? As a mechanism for getting massive Ws and Zs from theories we already know and love, massless non-abelian gauge theories. Tomorrow, I'll take a different tact and actually talk from the bottom up about why you might think that something like a Higgs mechanism has to be present in the standard model to make a theory of massive Ws and Zs consistent. Why can't we just write down massive vectors and be done with it? And then on Friday, and this might leak in a little bit into Thursday as well, I want to talk about the Higgs at the LHC, other colliders, and how you actually study this. This is the last undiscovered particle of the standard model, but there's between 2 and 3.5 sigma evidence for it at the LHC. So as of this winter, so it seems like it would be a great injustice not to spend some time on it. That last lecture is a Higgs lecture, unlike any that's been given in standard model lecture courses in years past. It's actually pretty exciting to be able to give it. All right, I'm going to start with the simplest example to really talk about details of the Higgs mechanism. So I'm going to start with an abelian Higgs example. So we'll just take an abelian gauge field, couple it to a complex scalar field, phi, sorry, no half there, minus v of phi, and I'll take v of phi to equal minus mu squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth. Now, there's a gauge invariance that leaves this Lagrangian unchanged, where a mu goes to a mu plus, let me get my convention straight, plus del mu alpha of x. And phi goes to e to the I, e to the minus I times a coupling e alpha of x phi. And sorry, this is a covariant derivative of d mu. D mu phi is equal to del mu plus I e a mu phi. Okay. If it weren't for these gauge interactions, this would look exactly like the examples you've seen of spontaneous symmetry breaking of spontaneous symmetry breaking in a U1. You get a Goldstone boson. Great. It's the Mexican hat potential. Here, This U1 is actually a local symmetry, or you can also think of it as a fake. Fake in the sense that there is, as you will see, not really a new, it's not really generating a new phase of the theory. There is no Goldstone boson. There is no physical deformation that takes you from one phase to another. It is really physically, these you should think of as really representing physically equivalent states, right? We never think of, although we can if we really want to, we never think of a mu as having a longitudinal piece proportional on shell to k mu that just doesn't couple to anybody but hangs around. We really think of this as the states with different k mu, with epsilon differing by k mu, are physically equivalent states, physically equivalent photon polarizations, and states with different phases of phi, therefore, are also physically equivalent states. They're really the same state of the theory. Nothing makes that concrete so much as spontaneous symmetry, as spontaneous breaking of this purported U1 symmetry that we've gauged. So we know, again, I know you've seen this potential before, we know that V prime of phi, let's say d V d phi, is minus mu squared phi star plus 2 lambda phi star phi mod squared. That equals 0 when mod phi squared is equal to mu squared over 2 lambda. Okay. Let's choose to take phi to expand around a vacuum where phi expectation value is mu over root 2 lambda. And I'm going to go ahead and call this, label this as v squared over 2. So then this is just equal to v. Now, again, in a case with an abelian symmetry that's not gauged, these are different vacua. Here, they're related by a gauge transformation. They're the same vacuum. But we will choose to parametrize it in this way. So if we were to look at something like phi equals v e to the I alpha, that would be the same vacuum. That would be just differing by a gauge transformation, by a uniform gauge transformation. We'd say it's the same vacuum. Even if we did something like we did in our in treating pions, where instead of taking e to the I alpha, we took e to the I alpha times some integral dk e to the I k dot x f of k, right? We pick out some momentum mode and actually have oscillations of phi. That would still be a gauge transformation of the same vacuum. So we can't excite anything while staying in this manifold of vacua. We can't excite anything that isn't a pure gauge mode of the theory. So staying in the minimum, in the manifold of V minima, we can only excite pure gauge. Okay. Now, I mean, that's not completely true, because if you look back at this, you say, well, wait a minute. In this case, if I did this, if I took a constant alpha again, then the transformation to a mu is 0. right? Because del mu of my constant alpha vanishes. And that really was just a pure gauge transformation. Here, if I were to do something like this, I have some momentum dependence, del mu alpha isn't zero. And it's really not just pure gauge. It can only excite, really we should say, it can only excite degrees of freedom equivalent to a transformation of a mu. I'm saying all this just as a setup to note the differences in how you think about the symmetry breaking already at this point, just identifying the vacua between the gauge symmetry and a global symmetry. So, okay, let's expand about this now. Let's expand about our vacuum. So I'll write phi to be equal to This should be a v over root 2. Phi will be equal to 1 over root 2 times v plus script phi e to the I a divided by v, so that all of my fields, so my new fields, are real field phi, it's a scalar, and a real pseudoscalar a, both with dimension 1. When we do that, our terms d mu phi go to 1 over root 2 e to the I a over v. Del mu phi plus I 1 over root 2 v plus script phi over v, del mu a, plus I, my old gauge term, a mu v plus phi. So all I've done is I've pulled this phase out front and just taken all the pieces of the derivative. Now, if I look at v of phi, it depended only on the absolute value of phi squared, as it had to, because we wanted this theory to have a U1 symmetry. And so it's only going to depend on script phi. It'll be a different potential because we're expanding about the vacuum, about a new vacuum. It's going to look like our mass term it'll have a mu squared phi squared plus, notice this actually means the mass, this is twice m phi squared, because this is a real scalar, it should have a 1/2 in front of it. And then we have a constant term that we don't care about, new cubic terms for phi. And of course the same quartic. Okay, but going back to this d mu phi. So a falls out of v. A also falls out of the d mu phi. equal to, so d mu phi mod squared, the phi kinetic term is just equal to 1 half the del mu phi squared term plus 1 half. This actually shouldn't have had a separate 1 over root 2 in front of it. V plus phi. Is there a question?
Why is it a plus mu squared phi squared?
There isn't. Sorry, why is there a plus in the can I rewrite the potential?
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at, let's actually expand it out. We have to include the V, point is in the V plus phi, there's the lambda V plus phi to the fourth.
Oh yeah.
Right? Over 4 because of all the root 2s, and then that's going to generate a 6 fourths lambda phi squared v squared, which I can rewrite in terms of mu using my expression for v. And then when I add that to the negative piece, this goes to just 3 halves mu squared. The bare term is a minus 1 half mu squared. And when you add them up, we get 1. So this is the standard picture where, as a function of mod phi, the potential has an unstable minimum at the origin and then a stable minimum at V. So here the mass squared is negative, here it's positive. Yeah?
So I know that in this case, the constant term, we don't care about it. But the classical value of this constant term, is that something that we care about in cosmology?
Yeah, so certainly this should be a contribution. So if we did keep track of our constant term, it would be lambda over 2 v to the fourth, I believe. And I might have the number wrong, but if I had a root g in front of this equation, then this would just be a contribution. This would not be a constant term anymore because there's a root g there. This would be a contribution, a small contribution to the cosmological constant that needs to cancel other small contributions to somehow give us the value that we see of the millielectron volt scale. So cosmologically, all of these constant terms that I've been dropping here, the pion system, every one of them looks like it contributes to the cosmological constant. And yet the cosmological constant is much smaller. Okay. I'll go back to this kinetic term. All right, so again, all I did is just take the I terms, square them, rewrite it a little bit. Now this, this has some mixed quadratic terms, so it's a little bit confusing, but this is the only place that A appears in the equation, right? And in fact, A always has a, and this is the only place that it, so this is the only place that A appears in the new Lagrangian we've expanded out. So this motivates us to just define, well, what if we define a field C mu, which was just a shifted version of A mu. A mu plus 1 over EV times del mu A. And if you check that del mu C nu minus del nu C mu has, of course, its term that looks like f mu nu based on A, plus terms that go like del mu, del nu, minus del nu, del mu on A, these clearly vanish. So, in fact, the C and A are gauge equivalent. Okay, I could view this as a field redefinition, or I could have just said, let me take a gauge where the phase of phi is zero everywhere. As I was saying earlier, that's the statement that no matter what minimum you're in, it's always gauge equivalent to one where you've only changed a mu, where you've changed a mu to precisely this. So I can rewrite in terms of C mu. And now what I've got is a Lagrangian for C that looks like minus a fourth f mu nu squared. I'll drop whether the f is from A or from C. They give the same answer. Plus all my usual kinetic terms for the matter for phi and A. Sorry, for phi. Plus 1/2 MA squared, MC squared, C mu times some interactions with matter. Okay, so now I don't even see this A degree of freedom anymore. I just have a theory with one massive real scalar, one massive spin one particle that are interacting. Okay, the complex degree of freedom of phi, which was just a phase, wasn't really physical to begin with, so maybe we shouldn't be so troubled that it's gone. But in a sense, it isn't gone. Why do I say it's not gone? Because if we look at the degrees of freedom in this C mu, see, a massless vector has two spin degrees, it has two helicities, right? Even though we represent it by a field A mu with four components, that's wrong. That doesn't count the degrees of freedom in a massless vector correctly. It just has two helicities, plus and minus. The way we get that from a vector field is, number one, we can impose a Lorentz invariant constraint like Lorentz gauge. That tosses out one degree of freedom. And we can declare that A mu of x proportional to del mu alpha is unphysical. That is one degree of freedom that we treat as unphysical. And so if we started from our 4DOF and A mu, well, now we get the correct match for the gauge theory. Two helicities plus and minus, 2 degrees of freedom really living in A mu. A massive vector is just a spin one particle. You can look in its rest frame and ask, what are its polarization states? And this is spin one like you learned it in quantum mechanics. You pick a z hat direction, and you look at Sz, which is the s dot z hat, and its eigenvalues are minus 1, 0, and 1. Formally, this is the difference between the little group of a massive particle, which is SO3, and the little group of a massless particle, which is just isometries of a plane. You have a question, Alex? You looked like you did. Okay. So these have 3 degrees of freedom. So you just take del mu A mu equals 0. That projects 1 degree of freedom, which would have had wrong sign kinetic term anyway. And you're left with 3 degrees of freedom matching up with a massive spin one. So where has that degree of freedom gone? Well, it was eaten. Here you see that it was really sort of eaten up into CMU, and this is what we call it. We call it a would-be Goldstone boson A being eaten by the vector field. It's eaten up by CMU. Doing this transformation, redefining CMU, if you will, if you view it as performing a gauge transformation, that's now fixing your gauge, right? You can fix a gauge where A mu is zero, and then you're no longer, where little a is zero. And then you no longer have the freedom to do these, to change this derivative part of A mu. You've lost your gauge symmetry, and you get a massive vector with the three components that you used to have. So what I'm saying is that if you count degrees of freedom in the high energy phase or in the low energy phase of the theory, you should always get the same answer. In the high energy phase, before the symmetry breaking, or let me just say before the phi not equal to zero, you have two real parts of your phi field, and you have 2 degrees of freedom in A mu. In the low energy, after expanding around a web of phi that's not equal to zero, you have 1 real part of phi and 3 degrees of freedom in the massive CMU. Yeah. There's a couple of different ways of thinking about it. Physically, if you look at a thermal field theory, so you start thinking about this at high temperatures, then there's always going to be thermal corrections to the potential that include positive mass squared terms for phi. When you add those in, then at high temperatures, those are going to eventually cancel this negative mass squared and give you a potential that looks positive here for T much greater than mu. In some sense, if you go to high energies, mass terms should always be irrelevant to the theory, and there is no need to talk about things in this other vacuum. Working in the unbroken vacuum is equally good, but I always find the thermal picture to be the clearest one.
Do we know any dynamics for going from high energy to low energy that seems to be working? Or is it just we know it wants it at the beginning and then that's it here?
You can do, in a given theory, you can do calculations of what the potential is at a given temperature. And for example, one can work out whether these are first or second order phase transitions. And if it's weakly coupled enough that you trust perturbation theory for that. We're not going to do any of that in this course. But just on dimensional grounds, you can reach this argument that at high enough energies, it's not broken. At high enough temperatures, it's not broken. All right, let's look at a simple non-abelian example. This is still not going to be the standard model Higgs, but it illustrates something different. Here we had a U1, it was completely broken. Let's gauge an SU2. And couple to a field by A in the adjoint of that SU2. So A equals 1, 2, or 3. Now we'll have a Lagrangian mu nu A squared plus our kinetic term for phi A minus some V of phi. I won't specify what this is exactly. I'll just demand that it's invariant. And d mu phi A, in this case, for an adjoint, is del mu phi A plus g epsilon ABC A mu B. Remember, A is also an adjoint, phi C. So suppose V of phi is minimized at phi A dot phi A equal to some V squared. And again, I can just pick where I want to work around. I can work around phi A equal to V delta A3. So in other words, my phi is entirely in the 3 direction. Now, if this were a global symmetry, we can go back and ask which subgroup of the SU2 does it break? Certainly breaking some of the SU2 generators. They'll move this around. It's useful to use the equivalence at the algebra level and also at the group level for the, as far as at the representation level for these adjoints. SU2 is sort of equivalent to SO3, the rotation group in 3 dimensions. And these phi A's, as well as the gauge bosons, can be thought of as just living in as vectors, unit vectors in 3-dimensional space. So here I've got my x, y, and z axis. What this is saying is just that my expectation of phi A is in the z direction entirely. So what subgroups of what SO3 generators would leave that invariant? Well, clearly, if you rotate around the x-axis, that would be the transformation generated by A1. That'll move it off into the yz plane. A2, rotating around the y-axis, that would move it into the xz plane. A3, rotation about the z-axis, is going to leave it unchanged. So A3 is a we'd say A3 is an unbroken symmetry. And if this were a global symmetry, then that leads us to think that we would have 2 Goldstone bosons. So what we might expect is that these 2 Goldstone bosons will get eaten by 2 gauge fields. To look at how that works, I'm actually going to stop. I'm just going to stop thinking about the perturbations of phi for a minute. We care less about them now that we know that one of them has a mass and the other one disappears from the theory. We can think of it as being eaten by a gauge boson. So I want to focus on the gauge boson sector. Just the gauge boson Lagrangian with phi A set to its VEV. So then we want to look at d mu acting on the VEV of phi A. That's going to be equal to just, so we're sending it to the VEV. The first term goes away. It's just equal to g epsilon ABC A mu B VEV of phi C, which we've set to be equal to V delta C3. So if you work that out, see right away that with this epsilon ABC, you're never going to get that d mu vev of phi 3 would have an epsilon 3b3, and that's going to equal 0. And that d mu of phi a doesn't involve a 3 for any a, because that would also have an epsilon a 3 3. So what is d mu phi a d mu phi a? When we sum over a, 1/2, it's just equal to 1/2 g squared v squared times a mu 2 squared plus a mu 1 squared. So in this setup, two of these gauge bosons get mass. And in fact, Georgi and Glashow tried to use this kind of model to explain how you would get massive W bosons. The problem with this model was in part that this massless thing, the A3, so A3 remains massless. Now you would expect the A3 couplings to matter, and these massive guys that you want to interpret as the Ws, you'd expect them all to have the same charge. Also, you wouldn't get weak neutral currents from this theory. So the observation, there was this problem of the charges, and the fact that this theory had no weak neutral currents, which were eventually found. So let's imagine that we've taken the same symmetry, the same theory, or rather the same gauge group, SU2, but instead, if we instead had a doublet field phi, getting a VEV 0V through its dynamics. And then we ask, well, what subgroup of the SU2 would have been left unbroken by this? So now we really have to look at sigma A as a matrix acting on 0V. And that has to be 0 for any, in other words, let me put it this way, the eighth generator is unbroken if sigma A acting on the VEV of phi equals 0, if rotations by e to the I sigma A leave it invariant, and for every A, this is false. So in this case, just by looking at the broken and unbroken symmetries, all the A mu would eat Goldstone bosons and acquire mass. In fact, as of, say, a year ago, most, and really to some extent still now, most of what we knew about what kind of Higgs boson the standard model could have was based on this kind of property. What kind of, and also detailed study of the fermions, that what kind of Higgs boson you have dictates the mass pattern of the gauge bosons. So if the Higgs is a triplet, we would have had a massless degree of freedom in the SU2, and if it's a doublet, there is absolutely no way, no matter how the doublet gets a VEV, of having such a mass.
That if we had a doublet and that was our Higgs Bev, then so does this break all the symmetry?
Yeah, this breaks all the symmetry.
All three SU two generators. What about sigma three? Sigma three, does that eliminate? But that's an eigenvector of sigma.
It's an eigenvector of sigma three, but a transformation by sigma three, right? So that means that it would still rephase v, right? If I took e to the I tau 3, e to the I sigma 3 times A, that would be acting on 0 V. That would give me back V e to the minus I A.
Right?
So it's still breaking it because the phase of that term matters. So let's go to the simplest realistic Higgs sector. So I'll have an SU2 cross U1 gauge group. And a field, again, phi, breaking the symmetry. A field phi will acquire a bev. Phi is an SU2 doublet. And has charge 1/2 under the U1. So that means that my d mu phi is going to look like del mu minus ig nua tau a for the SU2 part minus I G prime over 2, B mu times, I'll write it out explicitly here, although I usually won't, the identity matrix acting on this field phi. Okay, so this field phi is a two vector, and these are all 2x2 matrices acting on it. And this guy should also have an identity matrix. Now, this is really an SU2 cross U1. But we're talking about global symmetries. If I want to call this, I mean, this isn't a U2 in the sense that I'm choosing. It would be a U2 if I took G prime, required it to equal G, but I'm not going to do that. G prime and G are independent parameters, so I should really think of this as a separate SU2 and a separate U1. Now, again, let's just focus on what happens at the vacuum expectation value. So I'll choose the VEV of phi to be equal to 1 over root 2 times 0 V. Okay, like what I did there, except now I'm going to be more careful with 2s. Then d mu phi mod squared at the expectation value is going to equal this VEV of phi times the matrices IG, AMUA, tau A dagger. Tau A dagger is just tau A, so I'll drop that in the future. G prime over 2 V mu times minus IG AMUB tau B minus I G prime over 2 B mu phi. This guy would be daggered. So let's just think back to what we were just talking about. So we know that this phi breaks the SU2 completely. It also, and we already worked out how the tau 3 generator acts on it. It also, so it breaks all our standard SU2 generators. And the U1. The U1 also takes Vevify to 1 over root 2 to Vevify times e to the I beta, where beta is the appropriately normalized some U1 rotation. Well, notice the similarity between this transformation and the sigma 3. There's a combination. Of U1 and the tau 3 piece of SU2 that leaves the invariant. So that means that when we look at this, when we expand out this to get mass terms in terms of V for all four, for these four fields, there should be one zero eigenmode. There should be one linear combination of the A3 and B that's massless. What we find is indeed that we can write this as a sum of three mass terms. There's a G squared V squared over 2 times A1 mu squared plus A mu 2 squared. And then if I rewrite these as in terms of a W plus or minus, which will be 1 over root 2 times A mu 1 minus or plus I A mu 2, these will just give me the W mass plus. There's another term, which I can write as 1/2 as g squared plus g prime squared v squared times g a mu cubed minus g prime, sorry, a mu 3, not cubed, b mu squared. And I'm going to give this guy this sort of funny-looking denominator just so that this overall normalization is chosen so that this guy will have a canonically normalized kinetic term. So to have a canonically normalized kinetic term and this linear combination, I need to put in that denominator. And we see that the mass term associated with this guy is a little bit different. So let's define some fields in our new language. I already defined the W's over there on the left board. Their masses, you can just read off. So W plus or minus mu is 1 over root 2 A mu 1 minus plus I A mu 2, and the mass of the W squared is just G squared V squared. The Z mu, I'll define to be that other linear combination, G A mu 3 minus G prime V mu over the square root G squared plus G prime squared, and MZ squared is equal to G squared plus G prime squared times V squared. Now, it's convenient to define the ratio, it's the cos squared of an angle, cosine of an angle, G over this square root, which will appear all over the place, as cosine theta, the weak mixing angle, or the Weinberg angle. And then, of course, sine theta is the same with a G prime. Notice that in the limit that G prime goes to 0, so the sine, so theta Weinberg going to 0, this Z mass, the Z would just be a mu 3. The B mu would decouple. And the mass of the Z and the mass of the Ws would be identical. So in that limit, when I turn off the U1, I just get back to the situation I was talking about up here, with a doublet breaking SU2 completely. And that little weakly coupled U1 generator would basically still be massless and not doing anything, because it's so weakly coupled. So at the moderate, in the moderate G prime case, the photon, the fourth generator, right? The one that's massless, we obviously want to associate with the massless gauge boson that we know and love in nature. It's G prime times a mu 3 plus G B mu, just the opposite linear combination of these guys, over G squared plus G prime squared. And its mass is 0. If you look at the generator, at the 2x2 matrix in the kinetic term corresponding to this, what you'll find is that it's just an upper diagonal matrix. So I mean, adding the tau 3 piece to the identity piece from B mu with those appropriate linear combinations, that corresponds to a generator matrix which is upper diagonal, which means that the action on phi is trivial. So that's how you see it in matrix form, that it doesn't change phi. So you'll notice, of course, that MW over MZ is equal to cos theta Weinberg. Now, let's talk a little bit about,
historically, how do people distinguish between this model and the Glasher-Georgi model? Did we have to wait until the experimental evidence for the masses of the W and the Z came out?
There are at least two problems that people knew about well before the discovery of the W and Z directly. One is this one that the couplings of the photon wouldn't be right in this model, right? The couplings of the photon, I mean, neutrinos were known to have weak interactions and not be charged, for example. The other is that is just that in this model there were no neutral currents. Those were discovered long before the direct discovery of the W and Z, just indirectly through particle interactions, high precision. Now, I don't know what roles those two or other possible inconsistencies actually had historically, but it was certainly settled long before the discovery of the W and Z.
Right.
That if the explanation of the standard model structure was a gauge theory, and that's the question of whether that has to be is something I'll come back to tomorrow. If it's a gauge theory, some fundamental level, then there would really have to be an SU2 cross U1 structure. And that actually made predictions of the W and the Z masses. So just because you can write the effective operators for, say, the charged currents coming in terms of the coming in through the W, you can write down that effective operator in terms of, and solve for G Fermi in terms of the W mass and cos theta Weinberg and the electron charge. In fact, the expression that you'd get, it's getting a little bit ahead of myself, but it's important, is that G Fermi over root 2 be equal to E squared over 8 MW squared sine of the weak mixing angle. There were already ways before direct detection to get a handle on the weak mixing angle. G Fermi was very well measured in weak decays. E we know and love. I haven't related E in here yet because we haven't worked out the gauge interactions on matter yet. But E is just a simple function of these Gs. So then you could write everything in terms of E sine theta weak MW and solve this equation. These are known. G Fermi was measured and solved for the W mass get with some uncertainty. So this was something that could be done well before the discovery of the W. It was really kind of predicted from the bottom up where it should be. To finish that story, we do need to go back to how fermions interact. So let me go ahead and, I'm only going to cover up this board momentarily. Release it from its obscurity there. So we've now demanded the structure for the interactions in the theory, that there's really a fundamental, a hidden gauge symmetry, or a hidden gauge redundancy in the Lagrangian. And that's something that we want to make sure is respected by all the interactions. So when we add matter, there's two things we need to think about. There's the gauge, when we add matter, we need to think about making sure that it has gauge invariant kinetic terms and gauge invariant mass terms. Start with the kinetic terms. So let's just look at d mu psi and see how the low energy kinetic terms, particular interactions with the photon and neutral currents, are going to come out of this SU2 cross U1 structure. So this will always be equal to del mu psi times minus del mu minus I g a mu a times tau a minus I g prime b mu times some charge y, and each particle can have a different charge y, under this b mu. This is named hypercharge. So in principle, I've written here with the tau a, this would be for a doublet. I can write more generally TA here, where TA is a general representation matrix. So TA equals 0 for a singlet. There's just no interactions. TA equals tau A for a doublet. And if we were to go on, we'd get epsilon ABCs and so on. Tau TA BC equals epsilon ABC for an adjoint, and so on. But we'll only care about the singlet and doublet cases for standard model matter. So let's focus on the part of this that's where all the interesting stuff is happening, the diagonal elements in our basis, where the VEV is as we wrote it, is proportional to 0 V. So the diagonal elements are where all the action happens. The neutral pieces look like minus IG A mu 3 times I 3 minus IG prime B mu Y, acting on each component of psi. So what I mean is now this I3 on a singlet psi, it's a singlet under the U1, something like a right-handed, sorry, under the SU2. That would be zero. I3 is just parametrizing the eigenvalues of the sigma 3 matrix, which is diagonal in this basis. So on some doublet, call it psi upside down, for example, I3 would be 1/2 on psi up and minus 1/2 on the lower component, psi down. Okay, so this lets us, since these matrices are diagonal, I can just work out the actions on each component. And if I regroup this, these A's and B's, into the Z and the photon, what you find is that this is just equal to minus I GG prime over the square root of G squared plus G prime squared times I3 plus Y gamma mu minus I square root of G squared plus G prime squared I3 minus sine squared theta weak I3 plus Y times the Z piece. So, okay, this was associated with just defining that equation. So, what I'll do is I'll call this. This is just the, there's some arbitrariness in how I pick normalizations. If I can declare this to be E, and this is now the electromagnetic charge, Q. This here is the effective charge under the Z's interactions. And now we can work out, just from the known properties of the particles, what charges they need to have. So I've chosen my convention so that the electron would have charge 1, and its coupling would be E. That's how we usually normalize E. So I want electrons to have charge 1. Charge minus 1, actually. And the left-handed electron has weak interactions based on the charged currents. We think it should be in a doublet with the neutrino, so we can call that our lepton doublet. Then we can ask about the lepton doublet and the right-handed positron. Yeah.
Sorry, I got a bit behind. What was psi 1?
Psi 1, here I just meant if psi 1 is a singlet.
Oh, I see.
Sorry. For a singlet, I3 is 0, right. And I3 on the upper or lower piece is half or minus half. So, what's their SU2 charge assignment, and what's the U1 Y charge assignment? Well, the positron had better have electric charge 1, by definition. And we know that the weak interactions are chiral. Right-handed electrons don't have weak interactions. So that means it had better be a singlet under the SU2. I'm just going to right, singlets as a horizontal line, no transformation. That means that to get Q equals I3 plus Y, it had better be that Y for the positron, this is the left-handed field for a positron, for a left-handed positron is 1. In other words, for a right-handed electron, the hypercharge would be minus 1. This lepton doublet, well, we know that E minus should have, that the left-handed electron is going to have a T3 of 1/2. So this is a doublet under SU2. And I always write it this way. So the electron has a T3, has an I3 of minus a half. Isospin, that had better be made up by a charge of minus a half under hypercharge. And then for the neutrino, the two cancel, and you end up with an electromagnetically neutral particle. In the same way, we can work out what the properties of the other quarks have to be. So we'll again have the right-handed conjugates and the Q left. These guys have charge, are singlets under the SU2 and have charges 1/3 and minus 2/3 respectively. Remember, these are the antiquarks. And Q left, well, it's a doublet and it has a charge of 1/6. Now, that takes care of their gauge interactions. What about masses for these fermions? So now we see very clearly why it's hard to write down gauge invariant masses. Let's just write down the electron mass. So Lorentz invariance lets us contract left-handed spinners with themselves, not with bars. So we can write down E right conjugate. Well, that has charge 2 under U1y. So that's not gauge invariant. We can write down E right conjugate E left. That is not gauge invariant under either symmetry. This is a doublet, this is a singlet, and the hypercharges don't work. So there's no. And we last thing we want to do is start contracting them with the quarks, because then we'll introduce free color indices. So there's no gauge invariant way to give these fermions mass. That wouldn't be so if we didn't know that the SU2 was chiral. Then we could have chosen different charge assignments where the SU2 acted on both the left and the right-handed fields. And we'd think there was a gauge invariant way of writing masses with those charge assignments. But we know that the weak interactions are chiral. They do distinguish left from right-handed particles. And so we can't write down mass terms like this. We can't write down any gauge invariant mass terms for these fermions. Well, you notice, though, this combination here, it's Lorentz invariant. It has a hypercharge. Total hypercharge is 1 minus a half, so that's 1 half. And it has a it's an SU2 doublet. These are exactly the same quantum numbers as we chose for our Higgs. Right? So that means that I can write down a Yukawa coupling, E right conjugate. Well, I'll write it the way I'm used to. L, the SU2 indices contracted into the Higgs field phi, and then the Lorentz indices of the lepton doublet contracted into E right conjugate. Okay, so this is gauge invariant. It's Lorentz invariant. Sorry. He gets starred with these conventions and a perfectly valid term in the Lagrangian. We can similarly write down Yukawa's, as you know, you guys worked through this in the same way for the up and the down quarks. And then once you put this Higgs field to its BEV, you pick up a mass term for the electron for the up quarks and for the down quarks from those. So for today, we'll stop there. Next time, I want to, you're just logically forced in this direction, choosing these charge assignments and choosing this way of getting fermion masses. Once you try to interpret the W and the Z as coming from some underlying gauge symmetry of the theory. So Tomorrow we'll ask, do we really know that that's the case? How would we test that? And why are we forced to do something like that just for self-consistency of the theory? And then I'll talk more about the Higgs boson itself and how you can study it directly on Friday. Does anybody have questions?